Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem, not Brooklyn, not London, not Birmingham, from Jerusalem, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to the Land of Israel Network, and shalom, and welcome to Rabbi Mike Foyer. Shalom, and welcome.
Ah, so good to see you back, Yishai.
It's great to be with you here at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov in the heart of Nachlaot, once again, Jerusalem, and I've been gallivanting around the world.
That's how I picture you, gallivanting.
I have been gallivanting. Truthfully, in the last month, I was in the month of December, I was in San Francisco, in New York, and in Birmingham and London. And that was cool.
I've gone back and forth from here to Mali and Damim.
I was flying all over the world. I even flew business class one time. Yes, that's right. That's right. Don't even speak to me. Don't look up. Don't use my bathroom. And I also even brought over a knock hockey game. You know knock hockey?
Yes, I think so. I know
Zev, our mutual friend Zev was playing knock hockey at my house yesterday.
He must have been ecstatic. I know he's a fan.
Chaval al azman. He was absolutely in cloud nine because it brought him right back to childhood. And I brought this oversized game onto the airplane. Nobody believed that I could do it. I brought it from Brooklyn. And I also got to see a lot of Jews in Jewish communities, including a really exciting time in Birmingham. Birmingham is the correct way to pronounce it. And really with 3,000 Jews at the Limud Conference there in England was really very cool. And I wanted to talk with you before we get to the Torah portion, and this is Spiritual Cafe, where we talk about the Torah portion of the week and weave it into a daily life here in the land of Israel and in this incredible period. I wanted to talk to you about two things. The first is about England. I have to say to you that, Rabbi Mike Foyer, that I was pretty wowed by England. I was pretty wowed.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I was wowed about was a sense. It took me time to understand what I was being wowed about. You know, we're an ancient people, we Jews. We're an ancient, ancient people. But truthfully, in terms of peoplehood and ancientness, there's been a big break of 2,000 years. I mean, we've always been a peoplehood. We've always been ancient, but
but there was a big exile in the middle there.
Right, and that exile made us detach from our land, and it became a lot of memory. And when you come to Israel today, it's kind of a modern country or a country trying to be modern on some kind of very ancient basis. And we have to like dig up the dirt to figure it out.
And yeah, everything's either a 2,000-year-old ruin or brand new.
Right, right. So we say we're like I lived in Beit El. We're like, this is where Jacob had his dream of the ladder. And in 1973, we started this community again. And that's basically
4,000 years later.
Right. There's a disjointing of those times. When you go to England or the UK or Britain, whichever one, because I still haven't exactly figured out when to use it properly, even though I asked and spoke to people about this, and I found that not everybody can answer that. In any case, Malka and I took a half a day and we went to this castle, immaculately upkept. And you walked in and the whole thing of knights, wizards, warlocks, chivalry, falcons, tea, swords.
Tea was much later.
It doesn't matter. It was all like this whole British thing. And there was nothing outside of that. It was totally in that world.
Smooth continuity.
Exactly. It was like Disney World, except historical and real, not fake. And it also made me realize that, not surprisingly, the whole Harry Potter series comes out of England.
Yes.
Because it's a natural progression. It's just rehashing of those old Arthurian and all those British type tales. You go into this castle. It's fantastic. Then they literally gave us a show of hunting birds, including, you know, falcons and owls and all this kind of stuff. And the merchandising. Oh my God, you cannot even believe the merchandising. You could buy a sword and shield or a coat of arms on any fiscal level, any money that you want to spend, from a little bit to a lot. You could buy a real sword for $1,000 or many kind of things for your kids, but it was all one. It was all one. You know why? Because they have a tradition of 1,500 years, but it's been continuous on that landmass, speaking that language with their literature, with their thing. Their whole gig is one. And when you go in, there's nothing, there's no like Ashkenazi Jewry, Sephardi Jewry, black hat, no black hat, conservatism, reformism, Zionism, labor Zionism, political Zionism, Acharahamism, whatever it is. It's like, it's just a kind of has a natural flow in everything. And here's the other thing. They're good at upkeep. They're very good at upkeep. They're upkeeping their old stuff very well. They're a country that, like, they seem to shkia. They put effort into.
They invest in the past.
And I didn't go there to be jealous. I went there to learn. And wherever me and Malka go, we're always, our minds are in Eretz Yisrael and how we could better it. And this was my realization that we have a disjointed kind of history and past. And God is that's the way He wanted us. He said He would scatter us and ingather us. But there was something more, how should I say, organic feeling in the whole thing.
So it's a powerful image that you're painting, and it's one which is, I would just say, before we even get into any discussion, unavailable to us. It's unavailable because some essence of who we are is bound up with exile. And we see it today, as you and I have discussed many times, both with each other and with our peers, that how could it be that this incredible project, this revelation of God's love for Am Yisrael and fulfillment of the promise. Here we are sitting in modern Jerusalem. It's a sunny day. The sound of building is behind us. And yet there are literally millions of our brothers and sisters who are not here. Right? And it's because exile, you could say, was always part of who we are or has become part of who we are. That's kind of an academic discussion. It is essential to who we are. That's one piece. And it's difficult. It's very difficult. And it might just be that after another 1,000 years, please God, in our land, that it will look very different. The other piece I would say that, you know, I saw an article recently that it was talking about, you know, Trump's slogan, Making America Great Again. And there seems to be this sort of retro wave going around the world of whether you can call it a return to tribal nationalism, you can call it many things. And yet, Am Yisrael doesn't seem to be so into that. And I think because secretly, even though we are in many ways the original historical people, we're actually not about the past. We're about the future. Now, we understand that in order to get to a future, which is where we actually want to be, which is the fulfillment of that divine vision that we carry. So we have to be deeply immersed in our past. But we're actually about the future, right? We're moving toward redemption right now. And insofar as digging up the pieces of our past and reconnecting to them and maintaining them and giving ourselves some sense of continuity is critical for creating an identity in the present that is able to actually build that future, so then it's a worthwhile endeavor. But the real question, I think, is if for the British is that where you're headed, not where you're from. Because there's a great danger in being settled on a piece of land for 1,500 years. And as you said, investing in the past, in the maintenance of the past, how much of that energy is going also into the building of the future?
So I don't want to comment on England and where it's heading. Frankly, I don't even really know.
Right.
But I could tell you that my radar gave me not one of those senses that you would read in the newspaper that the whole thing's falling apart and Arabs are taking over. You know, England, there was a lot of Arabs in London for sure, or Muslim-type folks, I mean to say, in general. And I don't mean to cast aspersions, just as are. And we met actually two very nice Afghani. We took Lyfts, it was Ubers in... And we met some very nice Muslim folks, really. And we had long and very nice conversations. When they asked us where from, we said Jerusalem. And it was... very, you know, open and certainly not hostile discussion at all. And the city looked great. And I cannot comment on if it's going bad or not, where England is heading. I really don't know. But I could tell you that I was a little bit, how should I say, I don't want to use the word, let's say I'm not using the word jealous. I'm using the word, envious of just the refinement of it all. And I agree with you, we're people going towards the future, but our past is these the Torah, I mean, is a vision for the future, but it's very much a story of the past.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's exactly my point, is that though we have a discontinuity in our occupancy on this land, and the what always strikes me is the lack of a sense of aesthetic. You know, in places that have continuity. There's a sense of live. Like, I grew up in a suburb in America where the oak trees were massive and the houses were old. I mean, not compared to old here, but 100 years old, you know. And there's a sense of...
In England, there are regular houses that people live in that are 300 years
old.
Yeah,
sure. 3, 4, I'm sure. And so there's a sense there of something which is lived in, not worn down, but polished and upkept. So this is lacking in our country for sure, because like we said, everything is either a 3,000-year-old ruin or it's like been slapped together in the last couple decades,
like some kind of Bauhaus,
yeah,
thing,
postmodern art,
right? Some humid Tel Aviv Bauhaus or some weird sculpture that it's just...
Right. Well, I mean, and the reality is, as Rav Kook teaches us, the return of truly the art of Am Yisrael, with the truly creative side of us, is going to be a late stage expression of our return to ourselves. Right? Because an aesthetic which is really shaped by our national experience means that our national experience has to have some continuity first for it to emerge. But the thing that we need to do, and we were speaking about this before the show started, is preserve our creative sense of a vision that emerges from our story. That's where we have continuity.
Right, but I want to tell you about, I didn't want to get into this, but maybe we'll take just 2 minutes. I have a pet peeve. It's a real pet peeve, and it bothers me every year to the point of tears. And that is that I was just in America and in England, and let me tell you something. I knew that it was the holiday season.
Right.
You cannot but miss it. You cannot, because it smells like it, it sounds like it with the music pumping everywhere, and it certainly looks like it. I came into Israel in this incredible holiday called Hanukkah, which is so deep, so incredible, for everything from the roots of Adam and Eve to the roots of beating back Greco-Roman culture and
bringing light out of darkness.
Bringing light out of darkness, rededicating the temple, this incredible fusion of let's call it type of Zionism or a kind of national and
the
and,
spirit of the Maccabees.
Right, the spirit of the Maccabees that fuses with Torah. Incredible stuff. Yet I didn't know it was Hanukkah. One of my pet peeves around here in our beloved country is that we got to make Hanukkah great again. I want to make Hanukkah great again. And by the way, in Israel in the beginning, Purim and Hanukkah were majorly celebrated.
For sure.
The greatest Hanukkah lover was Ben Gurion and company.
Well, the reason that Hanukkah gets a short shrift, I think, in the public sphere here today is that there's this creeping sense of post-Zionism. Right? And people have a tendency to look at Hanukkah as this sort of like a cheap nationalism, and it's a deep misunderstanding both of the holiday itself, and also of what our mission in the world is, right? That I don't know.
Can we also enjoy a little cheap nationalism? Just I know we're speaking with Rabbi Mike Foyer, Spiritual Cafe. I know the depth of it, but also like when you drive in Texas and on the highway, there's a big sign, you know, that says the Texas State Highway. And there's right. a big American flag. Give me a little cheap nationalism.
No, but you said, can't we enjoy it? My answer to you is no, we can't. As a people, we cannot. And so therefore, to try to do so, I think, is a mistake. Whereas the reality is, if you actually dig into Hanukkah, the beauty of it is the depth is there. You don't have to enjoy it on the surface. That's not that you can't spin the dreidel play with chocolate coins and just have a little fun. But one of the challenges we have as a people, and I'm curious what you think about this, is that we're old. We have a sense of agedness that does actually not allow us to feel that youthful ardor. That was the attraction of Zionism. You look at early Zionist literature and early Zionist art, it's youthful. It's a stripping away. They rejected our history. They rejected all the baggage of religion. They wanted to be young and in the sun. And you know what's happened? That has played itself out in this country.
When I go to your community, when I go to other communities, I feel that youthfulness. I think that what you're talking about emanates from the Tel Aviv Zionists, Tel Aviv Israel, that has so many internal conflicts. What am I talking about? When I meet liberal Jews, I oftentimes help them get past all kinds of conflicts that have stopped them from going through a gate and loving Israel. Mm-hmm. Because there's something that conflicts with an inner understanding of life. And Israel comes in conflict with that, meaning to say, I'm a liberal Jew. I believe in human rights. Oh my God, these Arabs are being abused right. by my state. And therefore, I can't love it fully. But if I explain to you that most Arabs actually have a great life, and that really the Arabs that you're talking about, it's the fault of the jihad, which is not a movement for Palestinian self-determination, but it's really an effort to destroy Israel or other minorities.
And dominate the world.
And dominate the world. And I give you all these explanations, and suddenly your mind unlocks that door. Like a video game, you can progress into the next thing. So oftentimes, not only that, by meeting a person who has an answer, you sense that even if I don't have an answer, I know the guy who has an answer. Just like I know Rabbi Tendler and yourself and other rabbis that I know, that when I have a religious problem, I say, even if I didn't get through to Mike Foyer on the phone yet, I still know there's going to be an answer. I feel relief, and I don't feel that conflict. In Tel Aviv, Israel, there's tremendous amount of conflict. That has made us old. We can't love these things simply, because if I love nationalism, and you know, but at the same time, I I really don't want a temple because I know that the ultra Orthodox are going to stop me from being able to marry who I want and being able to stop me from going out to the nightclub. So therefore, I can't love Hanukkah fully because I know what it really means, and it means those guys in black, and those guys in black hate me. And that's the way Israelis think. That makes a person old. Inner conflict. As the rabbis say, "Ein simcha ela hatarat zvekot," right? When you have a doubt inside, you're conflicted. You start to be all, you know, in kind of upset.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what makes us old. I think it's an indication in the world. We're carrying so much, and baggage is such a worn word. We're carrying such a complex story.
I like baggage.
You like baggage?
Yeah, I like that. Makes sense.
We're carrying a lot of baggage. We've been on a very long journey.
Yeah.
We're home, but we haven't settled in.
Right.
Right? Because we didn't exactly walk
in through.
We haven't
unpacked.
We haven't unpacked. I mean, listen, I had a student once who said to me, you know, he finally gets it, that the halachic system was like we took everything. We were once in a land and we were a natural people. We packed up everything we had into our bags. And then we're back home, but we're sitting in the middle of an empty apartment with our stuff still in bags.
Right.
And I pointed out to him that the only place where he was wrong is we didn't come through the front door. We actually came flaming through the roof.
Right.
Right, and landed in the middle of the living room.
Right.
And so there's a tremendous unpacking that needs to be done.
Right.
And I'm going to push that issue. What I said is that unpacking is not about creating what was.
Right.
That unpacking is about seeing what we've brought with us in order to build what could yet be.
Right, but that's a lot of responsibility to unpack the past and to build a future.
It's a huge responsibility, but that's why I said I don't think we can enjoy cheap nationalism. Right. You might have our moments. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being happy.
I just mean to say that I always keep on coming back to this, especially in front of liberal audiences. I come back to the fact that there is a simple side also. That Russian side in me, at least, lets me be like, yeah, it's our land. And it's good. There's a certain kind of... There is also a lack of simplicity. When I hear certain speakers like the Hartman folks speak, they like make things so complicated. He actually, in a meeting with I had with Hartman folks, they told me, they're like, we like what you're saying because it complexifies it. I'm like, man, they love complexity. They enjoy complexity, even if there's none there. They like to...
I mean, look at rabbinic thought. I mean, you could say that this is the eminently Jewish way. I mean, one of the reasons people are afraid of the Tanakh, I think, is because it's quite simple in certain respects.
Right.
It's quite simple.
Right.
There's God, there's a promise, there's a people, there's a land.
Very good.
Did you get it yet?
Yeah. That's true. That's very interesting. Okay. Rabbi Mike Forrest, Spiritual Cafe, Yishai Fleischer Show, Land of Israel Network. We got to get to the Parsha, but I got to hit one more little bumper here. We'll keep it short. Yesterday, I caught myself dealing with my own inner conflicts and all kinds of issues, and I started realizing that I had negativity in my mind. Given that I'm a modern person who is on Facebook and on Periscope, and sometimes do live videos, I suddenly had an image of flying thumbs downs. I don't know if you've ever made if you've ever watched a Facebook video, like when somebody posts a thumbs up, like a thumbs up will fly across the screen.
Flies across, yeah.
Right. Or in Periscope, little hearts bubble up. You can hold down a hearts button if you like something, and little hearts bubble up.
In real time.
In real time. And you could be watching, and you say something that people like, and little hearts.
Oh, that's so dangerous.
Yeah. So, and people, you know... But I was using this imagery. I was like, oh my God, look at me. I have a lot of like thumbs up, down, running across my screen.
That you're putting there.
That I'm putting there. Like, yeah. I'm looking at the world and I'm like, thumbs down, this person, thumbs down, this situation,
thumbs down.
And I'm like, no. I'm like, and then I use the famous Chabad language, trach good and sein good, think good and it'll be good. And I started saying, not that I have to think about something that it will turn out well. Just think positive. Turn that frown upside down. Turn that thumbs down upside up. And I just started putting, in a very modern way, thumbs up across my screen and just thinking a good thought about people and just being like, hearts, 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 thumbs up, thumbs up. And I started, of course, noticing, no doubt about it, that the world started,
looking a little brighter.
It looked brighter. There's famous psychological experiments. Do you know about, I think it was at MIT, that what they did is they brought in students and they would say, okay, what we want you to do is we want you to curve your outer lip a little bit more down, a little bit more down. They would never say make a sad face.
Right.
And they would make a person look sad, and then they would say, how did you enjoy this? And like, I did not enjoy it.
Right.
And then they would force people to smile and then be like, yeah, it was fun.
That's
it was
great.
Good. And so I just, I forced positive thoughts onto my screen of the world, the world became a better and happier place.
No question, because it's the difference between being a passive recipient of life and an active participant in it. You know, and it's probably its most simple expression. But, you know, I can relate very deeply to what you're saying. We have a tendency to complicate things, get trapped in our minds, whether it's in judgments or intellectual constructs, or my happiness is dependent upon things that I can't control. The weather, the sociopolitical situation, the global jihad, all these things. And you know,
and where should I send my kids to school, and where should I live and should I run with this party or whatever it is, you know?
Well, those things are at least a little bit within one's control. You know Stephen Covey is, or was actually, Al Shalom, right? So he
business
has
business writer,
a writer about self-help, and he's the author of Seven Habits of Highly Effective People and High Effective Families, by the way. Excellent book. I can highly recommend that book. My wife and I have had tremendous assistance from that book.
Say that title again.
Seven Habits of Highly Effective Families. Covey was a Mormon who had 9 children. So lest you think he had nothing to say about highly effective families, he raised 9 children together with all the other amazing things he did. But the reason I mention him is because he has got a very important distinction, which I'm not sure if it's his own, but he articulates it as one's sphere of influence and one's sphere of concern. Is that if you think about it, there's a realm of which that we're worried about things, we care about things. It's very large. But when we look honestly at it and we say, well, but what can I actually do something about? It shrinks quite rapidly.
Right.
Right. And so what he says is that a person should spend the vast majority of their energy in their realm of influence. Not that you should give up caring about things. And so this is what I see is when you choose to be positive, what you're doing is you're bringing your realm of influence back down to the point of origin, which is my own being. That's where my primary realm of influence is. I actually am not a passive recipient. I'm not a product of my biology, and I'm not, you know, like just a...
I may be, but those things are not important.
Well, they don't define me.
Right.
No, I definitely am. Don't misunderstand. You absolutely... And they are important, but they don't define me. Right. Because my primary area of influence is the choice to be. Mm-hmm. Choice to be how I'm going to be. And so I think it's a very important tool that you're pointing out, which is just thinking positive. Imagetically or in negative talk in particular, if a person catches those sentences, self-judgments, you know.
Speaking of that, I want to tell you that God, I'm not trying to say that, I'm not, I don't want to overdo it here. You know, Rabbi Chaim Richman always says, why is it that Christians could say God spoke to me and Jews can't say that? one of the things that God is always smiting me with is stuff on my, in my mouth. I will get a sore. I will get a this or that. I will get a burn or something like that. And I always know it's because my majority of my efforts in this world are through this mouth thing.
Koch ha-peh,
right? And it's like whenever I do something good. So right now, I got a
Ooh,
little.
That's nasty looking.
Yeah, I got a little bump on my tongue. Obviously, lashon hara lamed hey, you know. And I just feel like I get that all the time, and I need to do a tikkun for that. Obviously, I need to zip my mouth a little bit more. And all of us could use that just a bit. But, you know.
I think the key is, and I just want to repeat it just so that people can think about it, is that a person has a choice whether to be a passive recipient of their life or their active engage in your life.
They call that mindfulness today?
Part of mindfulness. The first step of mindfulness is noticing.
Right.
Right. You have to be aware of the fact of all these thoughts and your mood, et cetera. And the next step is positive action.
Right. Okay. So we've talked about thumbs up across the screens. We've talked about continuity or discontinuity of history and how to get through them. As usual, of course, the show is about positivity. Let's get now to the Torah portion. Last week, we weren't together, Rabbi Mike, for it, but basically, there's going to be the very unpleasant, if you remember, the sale of Joseph by his brothers. There's going to be some very unpleasant aftershocks for the brothers because after Joseph gets sent down to jail, it gets sent down to Egypt. He becomes a servant in the house of Potiphar. Mrs. Potiphar is going to try to seduce him. He fights back, or he resists, more correctly, gets thrown into jail for 10 years. And in last week's Torah portion, he will... two Torah portions ago, he will... decipher the dreams of these two.
The butler and the baker.
The butler and the baker. And he's going to still stay in jail. Then Pharaoh is going to have dreams. Last week's Torah portion. And he's going to have, and we didn't get a chance to talk about this, Pharaoh's dreams. He's going to dream about 7 healthy cows being swallowed up by 7 very emaciated cows and 7 sheaths, sheaves of wheat, being healthy ones being swallowed up by non-healthy ones, and nobody could really answer to Pharaoh what exactly he wanted to hear. He didn't believe other people's explanations. They remember Joseph. Joseph gets run out of the jail cell. This is one of my favorite things, and we can't stop about it this week, so much to talk about, but the ability to be in jail for 10 years and then to totally be like, I'm with it. I'm ready to be the vice president of this giant empire.
Yeah.
That is an incredibly amazing thing that a few tzaddikim have, and we should emulate that. Meaning to say, if we're in a time of redemption after 2,000 years of exile and the Holocaust, we got to be ready for
that.
We
got to step up.
Right, and not be as and everybody has to watch as their homework Shawshank Redemption and not be
institutionalized.
We can't be stuck in the galut. Anyway, Yosef comes out, and then soon enough, and here's another point. Pharaoh's dreams are about, Joseph explains them as about being 7 years of famine, and then 7 years of plenty, and then 7 years of famine, and you need a guy who's going to work it out for you and gather all the food, and everybody's like, well,
where are we going to get a guy like that?
You know what? I think it's you, right? He's like, all right, I'll do it. I have another explanation to those dreams, and I think what Pharaoh's really saying is, we, Egypt, we're going to swallow you Jews up whole. Our culture is superior to your culture, and you're going to be, you are the seven fat cows, because don't forget that Joseph is described as the ox.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be seven fat cows. We're going to swallow you up. You're going to be the seven sheaves. Remember? He had a dream that he's the sheaves.
Sure.
He's like, we're going to swallow you up.
Interesting.
And the minute he's done with telling him his dreams and Joseph interprets the way he interprets, what does Pharaoh do? He gives him a new name.
Yep.
He gives him new clothes. And most importantly,
marries him off.
Right. A new wife. He does everything to erase Joseph and to make Joseph into a great American. I mean, Egyptian. Okay? And that's what he's out there to do. And we'll see that again in this week's Torah portion, that everything that Pharaoh tries to do is to try to utilize as much as possible the Joseph thing, but make sure that Egypt reigns supreme and that it destroys the Jewish story. In any case, the brothers, there's going to be a famine in the land, and the brothers are going to come down, and Joseph is going to recognize them. They're not going to recognize him, and he's going to start, there's only a good word in Hebrew, l'hitalel. Like, he's going to really afflict them.
He's
going to
mess with them.
He's going to mess with them. He's going to really mess with them back and forth. And he puts the money back into their bags. And he arrests one of them, Shimon probably. And he says, you have to bring down your other brother. And the father, Jacob, doesn't want to do it. And there's a famine. And finally, they send down Benjamin with the rest of the brothers. And everything looks like it's going fine and dandy. And then Joseph is going to plant the silver cup in Benjamin's bag. And they're going to create a false accusation against Benjamin as being the thief of this golden of the silver chalice, and they're going to say, we're going to arrest now Benjamin, and it was Judah who swore to Jacob, I will watch out for Benjamin and bring him back, or else I would sin to you all the days. And Jacob accepts that promise. Now Judah is going to this week's Torah portion face Joseph, face off.
It is the Clash of the Titans, right? And so much of it is hidden in the beginning, right? Because it's interesting that the tension in the beginning is that only Yosef actually knows what's going on, and yet Yudah has a sense that this is more than just a struggle over the brother, that this is existential, that these are two ways of being in the world that come to meet in that moment. And much of Jewish history...
What are the two things?
Yosef and Yudah, that Yosef, as you said, he has been swallowed up by Egypt. But because he's Yosef HaTzadik, he's Yosef the righteous, he actually maintains his sense of self as he's in relationship with everyone. That's Yosef's essence, is that his righteousness is in that he can become more Egyptian than the Egyptian. He doesn't just walk like an Egyptian. He is an Egyptian
right.
At this point. And yet he's still himself. He's literally the bridge between the culture of Israel and the culture of the world. Yudah represents the exact opposite. So we are who we are and nothing else, right? I'm from within the family. Yudah is leader of the brothers, and he's not stepping out into the world. He is the essence of what it means to be the head of what will ultimately be Am Yisrael. And these are two sides of the Jewish people that are facing off in that moment. This is a conflict that it's right. not going to go away.
And yet, at the same time, it's also the opposite. You said Joseph, he can be swallowed up, but always remains himself.
Judah is the essence of what it is to be closed off into himself. Right, with the world.
Right, but ironically, it's Joseph who has to fight off Mrs. Potiphar, but Judah, he seems to have he's the essence of the Baal Tshuva. He falls deep with the story of Tamar, and he married off Bathsheba. He married Bathsheba. He fell into a different world. He had to come out of that himself and be the real self. So he had to do tshuva to kind of cleanse himself from actually deeply falling into the pit of the outside forces.
Well, because each of these has what's called its kilkul. Each of these has its sort of negative overextension, right? Yosef can become so much like the Egyptians that he loses himself. But Judah could be so closed off that he can't have a relationship at all. And so we see that Judah is the line of Mashiach, of the Redeemer, and yet his whole line is bound up with these very strange stories about sexual interactions that will bring reproduction from Lot and his daughters, we spoke about long ago, to Judah and Tamar, which we spoke about not so long ago, right? All the way down to David and Bathsheba, which I imagine we'll speak about someday, right? There seems to be this wholeness of self that almost only breaks out in failure.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so they're going to face off, and the rabbis are going to talk a lot about this face-off between these two brothers, and it's like these two kind of kings, these two kind of kingly energies. Later on, we're going to meet that at Saul
and David.
And David, those two types of energies. Saul, of course, coming from the Benjamin line, which is like the Joseph line, related to the Rachel line, and as opposed to Judah, which King David comes from, and there's a real fight. And Judah is going to step up. And right now, we're actually seeing the ascension of Judah as the step-up brother. He's the one that kind of come behind step-up brother. You think that Joseph is the uber hero of the end of the book of Genesis, but it's also Judah who steps up. And in the end of time, he's going to actually take over.
Well, there's no question, because Joseph is a connector. That's his essence. His ability to maintain his integrity, even in the midst of Egypt, is what allows him to connect between things. But Yehuda is what's being connected to, right? Meaning, if we look at the Jewish people today, we move out of metaphor and speak about our lives today, right? There is a Yosef and Yehuda side to the Jewish people today. Right. There's that universalist aspect of Am Yisrael that longs to and is so good at connecting to everything, Western culture or relating to, universalist values, et cetera, et cetera. But
Joseph would have been a high-tech.
Joseph would have been...
Startup Israel.
Absolutely, and would have been marching for the refugees in Syria, right. Would have been, fighting for the battle of human rights in...
His card would have said Tel Aviv, London, New York.
I don't think we're getting too much into it, but the key to understand is that power of connectivity loses its meaning if there's not an essence that's being connected to. Mm-hmm. Right? Yehuda is the part of Am Yisrael that dwells alone, and therefore is the real gift that we have to bring to the world. Now, Yehuda without Yosef is isolated, right? It's completely other, and therefore can't bring its gifts to the world. But Yosef without Yehuda is just connectivity without meaning. It's the, I've got 10,000 Facebook friends, but nobody shows up to my funeral, right? Because I don't actually know anyone.
That's a sad image. So there's a tussle here, and the rabbis are going to see it as like a fight of kings. It's like kings are really struggling.
Because
yeah,
they're
with
different models of Malchut, for
right.
sure.
At the end of the Torah portion, of course, we read the Haftorah, which is the Haftarah, which means the, it's not the Half Torah, by the way. It's the Haftarah, which means kind of the end, the inclusio, the final part. And that's going to...
And it's a commentary on the Torah portion in its own right.
It's a commentary on the Torah portion. This is going to be from Ezekiel chapter 37. And it's going to talk about how these two sticks of the Joseph line and the Judah line are going to come together at the end of time.
Can I give a plug?
Yeah.
That if a person has never read chapters 36 through 38 in the book of Yechezkel and Ezekiel, you must do it now.
Right.
These are some of the most important chapters in the entire Bible, because it is a vision of awakening from exile into redemption. And I believe it has tremendous wisdom for our day.
So if you want to read the script of today, stop, drop, and roll right over to the bookshelf and pick up chapter 36, 37, 38?
Yes. I think that's enough. I mean, truth is, you should read the whole thing. But
right, no, those are tight. Those will give you a tight vision of the Holocaust and of the rebirth of the Jewish people in the land of Israel and the messianic process.
And particularly the piece that you're putting your finger on now is just that these two sides, and the Holocaust, unfortunately, is a great example. What is the message of the Holocaust, right? What's the primary lesson? We've spoken about this before. There's half of Am Yisrael that says the message of never again is we'll never let this happen to anyone else again. And they're out there, I think rightfully so, fighting against what's happening in Syria and concerned about Sudan.
And that we're all potentially
Nazis. And that we ourselves are should never, ever fall into that trap. The other side of Am Yisrael is saying, I'll never let you do that to me again.
Right.
And the reality is they're both right.
Right.
They're both right. And so that the ability to reconcile and not to have one al cheshbon on the account of the other, that's what we're not able to do yet. That's that split within Am Yisrael. How do we be totally committed to ourselves and realize that our commitment to ourselves is in service of universal redemption?
All right. So Judah is stepping up to the plate. He's fighting with Joseph, and he basically says he reads him as though he knows that he's really Joseph. He kind of reads them this emotional story about, like, our father. He loves the son Benjamin, and he lost the other son, Ogivalt. And I can't go back home without bringing back Benjamin. If I do, our father is going to die. It's going to be your fault. and take me instead. Take me. I'll stay here, your prisoner and your servant. Let Benjamin go back home. Joseph is overwhelmed at this point. He's been playing it tough the whole time. He's been strong and silent this whole time. And now suddenly he literally breaks down. He has a breakdown moment. Casts off all the other Egyptians that are in the room, reveals himself to his brothers, and he basically says, I'm your brother Joseph. You didn't sell me down to Egypt. It was God. And there's going to be a famine for 5 more years. And so therefore, you all have to come on down to Egypt and live here. I will feed you. And go ahead.
No, it's just critical that maybe listeners aren't aware that what Joseph has done through this all, like this hitolelut, right, this messing with them, is he's brought the brothers right back around to the moment where he himself was sold.
Right.
Right? Because it's critical.
He hears them. He hears Reuven say,
I told you not to do it.
This has come to us as karma, as boomerang for what we did to our brother.
Right. And this is the Rambam's definition of what we call tshuva gemura, of complete repentance. That, and the Yosef knows that in order to reveal to them that actually it wasn't their fault, so to speak, that God himself, but not have them then say, well, then I don't have to worry about the consequences of my behavior. Right? The depth of what it is to be able to look at God and say, I know everything's from you, God, but I'm still responsible for what I do. They have to do that moment of tshuva. They could abandon Benjamin right now, just like they abandoned Yosef. And instead, Yehud himself, who was the one who suggested selling Yosef in the first place, Yehud himself is now the one who offers himself in his place. Yosef realizes, okay, that's it. The process
They've
is done.
They've done tshuva.
They've done tshuva, and now I can reveal them the truth, which is really, it's all from God.
Right. But I have a problem here.
What's that?
Okay, my problem is that there's somebody else that needs to do a little tshuva, and that's Joseph himself. If we remember Joseph in the beginning, one of his problems was that he was talking bad smack about his brothers, and that he allowed his own father to clothe him in this cloak of stripes, or this Technicolor dream coat, and that he had a haughtiness problem. He would share his dreams in a public kind of audience. He would get under their skin. He would be annoying. And frankly, I have to tell you, every year I read this, and for some reason, when I read it, I get put into the position of the brothers listening to this Joseph.
You're an older brother, aren't you?
I am the oldest brother, it's true. And what happens is that there's a monologue here. He goes on a very, very long, biblically speaking, a very long monologue. The monologue is like, you didn't do anything. It was all from God. And there's going to be, for 5 years more, there's going to be a famine. Like, how do you know? Oh, you're a prophet, Joseph? And he's going to say, and now you see it's me, and my brother sees that, my brother Benjamin sees that it's me, and now I want you to bring our father down and tell him that I'm wealthy and superior here in Egypt, and bring him down, and I'll send lots of food, and I'll take care of all of you guys, and don't you... There's something about it which is annoying. It's haughty. There's a haughtiness. It's not self. There's no self...
abnegation.
Right. It's like I am what I am. I'm the big shot. You guys did a bad. Don't worry, because God knows better than you anyway. And I know something that nobody else knows, and this is the way it's going to be done. And to me, I find it to be... There's something agitating about it all. There's something agitating about it. And it's, to me, his character never changes.
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't know that I would say that Tshuva is what he requires. Maturity is what he requires. Meaning, he is the quintessential annoying little brother in the beginning of the story, right? I was a younger brother, by the way. I am a younger brother. And while you're correct that you could read his speech here as saying, well, he really hasn't learned anything. He's just going on and on about himself, right? At the same time, everything he says is true.
Absolutely. Right? And he's spot on every time.
Well, and so
he's always been spot on.
Well, he's always been spot on. And the difference here is he now understands that the definition of humility, of anava, right, is not pretending to be less than you are.
Right.
It's being exactly what you are. Right. And it's the problem was when he was a 17-year-old little younger brother who was mouthing off about being king of the world, that's not what he was.
Right.
Right. And now he's actually come into that fullness, and it's an honest statement. And to be less than that, right? And I believe that he's also internalized that message, because remember, if everything came from God, when he says, if he's able to say to his brothers, you didn't sell me down the river, God did, then he's also able to say about himself, and I am not the one who is saving you.
Right.
God is. In fact, that's exactly what he says, is God sent me before you in order that I be able to sustain you in the land. And
absolutely.
Notice it's for their sake.
Right. Though it is important to note that in the Psalms, later on, way later on, there's going to be a phrase that God's going to say, I rejected the tents of Joseph, and I choose the tents of David. I reject Shiloh.
Yes.
In the Benjamin region. I reject that
model.
Model, and I reject also King Saul. I reject that whole. There's some point where I say no to that, and I'll take the Davidic line, and I'll take that forever.
I think that a lot of it has to do with that aspect of connectivity, which is about wanting to be other than what you are. Right? Remember that Saul is a great example. The people asked for Saul that he should be a king just like the nations around us.
Right.
Right. And that Yosef ultimately cannot be the model of Am Yisrael's leadership, because he lies outside of the land, both in physical essence and the sort of in his real being. Right. In the end of the day, the Davidic line is the line that is able to articulate the true nature of Am Yisrael, that can be a heart amongst the nations, embedded amongst nations, because of course of a heart right. without a body is just a piece of meat, right? But nevertheless, must be itself. Its primary aspect is not its connectivity.
So a lot of people explain really that the Joseph side of things is like the infrastructure, the creation of the vehicle in this world, and the spirit, the soul, and the heart of it has to be the Judean line. If you think about Israel today, really it's got two sides. It's got a side that we're so proud of, the army side, the high-tech side. The creation of a viable state, it's not the religious people who created that. It's
not
really
at all.
It's really the Joseph type energy, which is the creation of infrastructure, international relations, a government, and all the trappings of a state, and that is a great success. That is a great success.
Huge.
But then within that is a heart. It happens to be in the heartland, the Torah heart, the Judean Samaria heart, the ancientness, the story of the spirit that has to go into that vessel. That's called the Judean side of things.
Yeah, and what worries me is the transition from Jew to Judean. Meaning, I don't think religion is a sufficient model for how to breathe real life into a full people, right? It carries, like we were speaking about before, it carries all of the riches that our baggage. We packed it all up when we went into exile. But religion is essentially packed up, right? To unpack into the land, we have to figure out how it is we can be Judeans again and not just Jews in order to breathe life into that Yosef structure you're speaking about.
I think that's a good title for an essay. I think right there, Jew to Judean. I like that very much. I think there's a great thought there about the transition
of embodied spiritual life as opposed to religion.
Deep thoughts here, very deep thoughts. Okay, speaking of deep thoughts, there's news out in the Israel family that Joseph is alive.
Right.
Yippee!
That's big news.
That's big news. Oh my God. What? I mean, it's good news. It's great news. But it's also like, does that mean that the little story's going to come out about how we lied to our dad?
There's some questions that it raises.
Is he going to tell and stuff? Or is he going to get back at us? Because now he's got the power and we're disempowered. We're literally disempowered because there's no food in the land. We're literally dependent on Joseph for food. We are physically bound. We are under him. We are his servants in this case, because he's really, he will be, what's the word, lechalkel? He's
going to have to sustain them.
Sustain us. That's sustain. Anyway, that's bridge problem number one. The other one is, somebody's got to tell Jacob. You know, he's been mourning all these years.
22 years.
He's been in a bad shape. We got this dad. Yeah, we sold our own brother. Yeah, we faked his own death. And we didn't expect our dad to be so upset for so long, which is way more than we bit off way more than we expected here. Now we got to tell him that Joseph is alive. They come up. They're like, Dad, you know, you might want to sit down for this. Got something to tell you. You know, that mourning that you've been doing, which, by the way, to his credit, he never let go. That mourning, the continuous mourning, means to say he always sensed that Joseph was probably alive, or at least that's the way I understand it. They say Joseph is alive. He doesn't believe them. Then he sees these carriages. He sees these Egyptian...
Covered wagons,
these, but also royal ones. You know, the royal ones, the official ones. This is not just like a storybook. There's stuff outside. Right. Again, Joseph. Like, there's stuff.
Oh, yeah.
There's stuff that represents Joseph. There's food, and there's carriages. And by the way, later on, the Torah is going to talk about the knees of Joseph, next week's Torah portion, that they grew up on his knees. And later they're going to talk about the bones of Joseph. He's always got stuff. Associated true. With him, there's always like material. He is the stuff of material success, and Jacob is going to see it. It's like it's a really powerful moment in the Torah where Yaakov is like, okay, let me go see Joseph. I'm going to see Joseph before I die. And here's another very powerful moment for me personally. I think for all of us that understand the importance of the land of Israel, it's two times in the Torah that Jacob leaves the land of Israel. Both times he needs kind of permission. He goes to God and he stops at a holy place. The first time he stopped in Beit El and God gave him a clue. I'll be with you and I'll bring you back. And so too, before leaving the land of Israel, Jacob stops in Beersheba, his father's city. Okay, not Jacob's city, by the way. Jacob didn't live in Beersheba. It doesn't say it's Isaac's in Abraham's city. He stops there. He sacrifices to the God of his father. And he kind of looks at God and he says, you know, do I have permission to leave? God says, I got you covered, man. This is all right. You're going to go down there. Joseph is going to close. He's going to put his hands on your eyes as you die. Everything is going to be good. You're going to die happy.
And most powerfully to me is, Al tira. Don't be afraid. I mean, it speaks so deeply to what it was that Yaakov was looking for. Right? Because you would think that there's nothing to be afraid of at this point. He's got the good news. His son is alive. He's not just alive. He's in charge. They're going to survive the whole famine thing. And so what's he so afraid of? I think the answer is quite simple, is that he knows a life of connectivity to God in the land.
Right.
It's not so clear to him that if he leaves, that God will be with him. I mean, remember the whole Beit El exchange was, if I go away and come back, you will be my God.
Right.
And at this point, he doesn't really have a context for knowing that God will be with him. He's quite old. But I think most deeply that what he fears leaving behind is that connection to God.
I think he also fears, what Pharaoh dreamt. Will we be swallowed up by this superior, powerful culture that is so big and powerful? We've been here in the land of Canaan talking to God. You know, it's a little bit of...
Raising the family.
And this is very... Now you want me to move to the big city and to this big Egypt. And everybody's going to want an iPhone, and there's going to be, you know, a lot of billboards around with naked girls, and there's going to be a lot of stuff going to draw me in. Are we going to stay Israel?
Right. Will we lose the connection?
Will we lose it? Are we going to get swallowed up by the Egyptian skinny, emaciated cow? And that's the fear. God says to him, no worries. You can go down there.
Not only that, but that God is going to go with him.
I'm going to go down with you.
Right. He says, Anochi ered imcha, v'anochi alacha gam alo. Right, I will go down with you, and I will bring you back. And it's really the fulfillment of that original promise at Beit El.
Right.
There, Yaakov makes a vow, which is conditional. If I go and come back and you take care of me, then you'll be my God. Now God is reversing it to him, saying, wherever you go, I am with you.
I want to tell you, Rabbi Mike, that I've heard a lot of rabbis recently in Chutz Laaretz, outside of the land of Israel, basically say something along the following lines. They say, we're here living in Galus, in exile. We go to Israel to get strengthened in our Torah so that we can come back and live with Lavan, so we can come and have Torah here in these dark moments. And I'm like, your version of history is that we live permanently outside of the land of Israel. We go to Israel to receive a little Torah, and then we leave with that Torah that we gained. That is not the arc of biblical history. The arc of biblical history is we're in the land. Sometimes we've got to be exiled, and then we go back to the land. God says, you know, you're going to go to exile, but I'm going to bring you back. That's the arc.
Yeah, not only that,
where the boomerang flies from.
Yeah, it's a question of what's your origin and what's your mission. Right. I remember there was a story they told about Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, that there was a famous educator, I think he was actually from England, who wanted to make Aliyah, and he was worried about Parnassah, about making a living, because he was a Torah teacher, he was an English speaker, and you know, I can tell you here in Jerusalem, then as now, you swing a stick in the streets of Jerusalem and you'll hit 5 English-speaking teachers of Torah.
Right?
Not so easy to make a living. So he went to Rav Tzvi Yehuda when he was in the yeshiva there in Merkaz HaRav, and he asked him, what should I do? And Rav Tzvi Yehuda said, make Aliyah, and then you can ask me the question. So it took a few years, but eventually this gentleman did indeed make Aliyah, and he came to Rav Tzvi Yehuda and says, okay, Kvod HaRav, you know, I spoke to you. Of course, Rav Tzvi Yehuda remembered exactly the conversation. He said, okay, now you can go on shlichut. Now you can go on a mission, meaning you have to understand where are you from and where are you headed. To treat Eretz Yisrael as a vacation destination is to misunderstand the nature of our relationship with this land. That doesn't mean that you can't plant yourself here and then feel your sense of mission out to the world. There are plenty of Jews out there. There are plenty of non-Jews out there. There's a whole world out there. Yosef is correct. We need to connect. But the problem is if you don't root yourself in Yehudah in a sense of place and wholeness of self, just think about how it is in a normal relationship. If your whole relationship is based on serving the other, I want to be like this person. I love them so much. I want to understand their needs. I want to meet them where they are, etc. If you lose your sense of self, that's not a relationship. It's unhealthy.
Right.
Right, you actually have to be who you are, and then from that place, yes, please,
but after,
reach out.
This comes back to the beginning of our show. After 2,000 years,
it's hard to know who you are,
and it's hard to know what your place is. If you're really good in New York, if you're good at it, I mean, you're really good at it. You get New York, you are New York. You build New York.
Yes,
the British Jews also. There's so many layers there of, and you know, as well as anybody, the layers of Jewish relationship to a place like London and. There's this nobility there in England. There's this other thing, these lords and this whole thing. There's a deep relationship. They feel like they're part of the buildings.
Listen,
in material.
Don't misunderstand me.
But that's where Joseph is amazing, by the way. That's why I love Joseph so much in that sense.
Yeah.
Because he himself actually is a great Egyptian, and yet it is well known, and you could see it in the verses, that he's always conscious of the Hebrew land that he was taken from.
His last statement to the brothers is, you must take my bones and bury me in Eretz Israel.
And it's going to be his grandson, Yeshua ben Nun,
who leads the conquest
and the return to the land of Israel.
I just want to be clear that this is a tremendous task that we're facing after such a long exile, and I don't want to understate the challenge, but at the same time, it to me is noteworthy that it's very similar to the many challenges we face as a human species right now, right? You know, the economic lifestyle we've built as a human species is eating this planet alive right now. But to ask the individual to actually change their personal behavior for the sake of some large collective that they can't even imagine, that's a big step.
Sure.
So in the same way, to get the Jews to leave these good, I don't want to be judgmental, good, healthy, positive environments that they're in, to come here where it's often more difficult and they don't necessarily speak the language and they don't know what to do here. That's a big request. At the same time, it needs to be done.
Right.
Because if we're really going to meet our purpose in the world, then we need to be doing it from a place of home.
Let me tell you, Rabbi Mike, as I travel to America and other places, I'm oftentimes in a struggle. An emotional struggle to deal with where I am. How do I relate to the big, beautiful synagogue that I go to?
Right.
How do I relate to the people? And I've been struggling with this for years because I've been traveling and dealing with the issues of Aliyah and other issues like that for years. And it's always, I land in America and it's a struggle because how am I supposed to deal with my fellow brothers Jews? Do I turn them off by just talking about Aliyah? Also, P.S., I feel the tug, right? Mm-hmm. I'm an imperfect being. I feel the tug of New York and London, whatever it is. Or San Francisco. So I have actually, this past trip, after many years, something happened where I actually figured it out.
Really?
I figured out a formula that works for me. I bless people. I just bless them. I say what I say, but I bless them to succeed. May God succeed you. Whatever you choose. You want to build a synagogue? I also bless you. I'm not going to judge you, brother. I'm calling you home. That's part of it. But I want you to succeed whatever you choose. I love you. And I'm going to bless you. I'm going to tell you about Israel. I'm going to connect you to the story. And if I could help you come on over, good. And if I can't, then I'm going to connect you to the story so you're going to be part of it. But whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to bless you. I'm not going to curse you. I'm not going to say, what the hell are you doing out here and all that. I'm done with that. I'm really going to bless you. I'm going to bless. And I get up in front of shuls and I say, I want to bless the Torah of this institution. I want to bless the rabbi. I want to bless your families. I want to bless you to succeed and grow. Bless you. And that's how I'm going to approach you, my brothers. I'm going to tell you about other things, but it's going to not come from a place of like, I need or I want or you should. I'm just going to bless you. And it freed up a lot of, that's what I was telling you earlier. Like once that intellectual and emotional and spiritual key opened, I suddenly felt a lot better about everything and about my mission there.
I mean, it's beautiful because, of course, Yosef that we're speaking about is Ish Matzliach,
right?
He is the person who brings success. And everybody notices that their lives are blessed by his presence.
Right.
And so it's a very powerful bridge that you can serve between knowing who you are and where you're from. And yet, therefore, being able to step out and meet people where they're at.
Yeah, yeah. It really was, for me, a big...
Sounds like a big switch.
It really, like, I suddenly, instead of being uptight and in constant struggle, internal struggle, I suddenly felt out of, you know, not in that struggle anymore. It was fantastic. Okay, speaking of blessings, Jacob is going to come down to Egypt, and one of the famous blessings of Jacob is going to be not to his kids. That's in next week's Torah portion. It's going to be to Pharaoh. He's going to bless Pharaoh twice. And he stands in front of Pharaoh. Very strange incident. He stands in front of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's like, "How old are you, man? You are
picture
so,
Yoda. Right? Picture Yoda.
Oh, I am very old. You know, it's like. And then Jacob gives this strange answer. He says, "Few and bitter have been my days. Few and bad have been my days." And it's like, "Hey, wait a minute. Come on." You're a Torah patriarch. Say something positive. You know, God is good and everything's good. And you know what? It's all good. It's been good. You know?
He's had a hard life.
He's had a hard life and he says so.
Yes.
The rabbis, the penultimate thing you have to know about Torah and Judaism is that we rip our own heroes. Okay?
Arayom hazeh.
We rip our own heroes. That's the essence. If you're going to be like nice about and think that our heroes are going to be perfect and nice and all that, then that's not Judaism. Judaism.
Keep that in mind if you're going into the rabbinate as well.
Right. Right. You will suffer persecution, okay, because that's the way our people do it. He's gonna say, yeah, bitter have been my days. The rabbis are going to chastise him for saying these. Even some people say, I think, that he lost some years of his life because of that. But
there is a perspective, yeah.
Yeah. In any case, you know, he is going to bless Pharaoh, and he's going to bring his whole family down there. He's going to send Judah ahead of him in order to establish a place for himself. It's understood that he established yeshivot. There's a joke. You want to hear a yeshivish joke?
Sure.
I love this yeshivish joke, but only yeshivish folks are going to get this
joke. I'm always looking for more
yeshivish jokes. Okay, this is a great yeshivish joke. You know that the explanation is that when Joseph sent him the carriages, so he's like, oh, the last thing we learned together was Egla Arufa. What's that in English?
The broken neck calf.
So the yeshiva's joke is that when he's like, oh, he's still studying that sugya be'iyun, forget it, we need a new yeshiva. Send Judah down to start a new yeshiva. All right, that's for the initiated. Don't worry about that. In any case, yes, the brothers are going to be, they're going to come down to Egypt Jacob's going to bless Pharaoh. And the Torah is going to enumerate all of the 70 souls that came down to Egypt, and the Egyptian exile begins.
Yeah, it begins, and it doesn't really begin as exile, right? There's an image here it's a very visceral image of an implanting in a womb, right? Because what you have here is this seed of a family, which at the beginning of the book of Shmo will already be transformed into a concept of B'nai Yisrael. But now it's
literally... Are you saying this is the first...
artificial insemination?
Yeah, but what do they call it when it's in a...
Oh, IVF? In
no, when it's, when it's in a non-mother, what's it...
Surrogate.
Yeah, is this a surrogacy? There's a surrogacy.
There is a surrogacy that's happening here. Because
the womb is the womb of Egypt.
The womb is the womb of Egypt. And
it wasn't conceived there.
Not conceived there.
Right. I mean,
specifically, we get this image, right, of being planted in this material womb, which has been prepared for them by Yosef. And then the intensity of that preparation actually gets the description in the end of this this parsha, where it talks about how Yosef basically creates slavery.
Oh, and that's what I wanted to ask.
At the end of this parsha, that he creates slavery because of people's hunger. They first give their possessions, and then they give all their money, and then they say, we'll sell you our bodies. Just please feed us. And what you see here is the preparation for the slavery and the transformation of the family of Yaakov into the people of Israel is all happening at the hands of Yosef.
What is this Yosef? He's a man that not only brings the Jewish people. He could have easily, by the way, been sending them carriages out to the Canaan every
six
months.
He could have fed them every week. Right, exactly. Right.
No biggie. He's a people mover. He moved the Jews from Canaan to Egypt, and he's going to move Egyptians all around. It's literally going to say that he's going to move them from one end to the other. He's a social engineer of radical proportions.
Yeah, and in doing so, he paves the way for the birth of a new model of nation, right? And that's a discussion that we'll have going forward. But the process of gestation that's going to happen through first the settling in Egypt, and then the slavery, and then the suffering, then ultimately the birth, right? Is really all set up here in this powerful personality of Yosef, which I have to admit, it's somewhat of a mystery to me.
It is baffling,
right?
However baffling it is a key part of the story of the Book of Genesis, the foundational story of the Jewish people.
It's the culmination in certain ways. Meaning, if you think about what what DNA is, right? All of the Book of Genesis up to now has been the spiritual source code of the Jewish people. Right, and it could have remained this sort of like abstract spiritual source code, but instead Yosef prepares a womb for it in order that it comes down into Egypt, can actually literally draw off the most powerful physical empire of the world at the time, and then be birthed out to now go about growing into Am Yisrael.
We'll be dealing with the birth of Am Yisrael starting in, or the beginnings of the birth pangs, starting in two Torah portions next week's blessings, and the end of the book of Genesis. In the meantime, blessings to you wherever you are from Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com. Lots of great Torah there. Rabbi Mike Foyer's show, other show on the Land of Israel network is called The Jewish Story.
That's right.
And there's a lot of great stuff there as well. There's many other great shows. Josh Haston, Rabbi Shlomo Katz, Ari and Jeremy, Eve Harrods, many other great shows, and many new shows are coming as well. And of course, the Yishai Fleischer Show. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. I want to thank all the good people that make this show happen. If it's Moshe Herman, if it's Tabitha, if it's Ben, if it's the Land of Israel Network, and all the folks that are behind that, I want to thank you so much for producing that. I want to thank all the folks that are supporting the Yishai Fleischer Show. Please check out my brand new website, yishaifleischer.com. It's brand new. It's hot. I hope it's hot. Let me know if it's hot. Let me know if you find any bugs in it. There's a donate button there. You know, you could click that if you want. And a lot of work has been going into it. And I want to thank all the folks that are supporting the show. I'm not going to enumerate them right now, but there's a lot of good people out there that are part of it. I just want you to know that this incredible Torah that you just heard is in your merit and honor. May it be a blessing to you. Folks, living in the Land of Israel is a blessing. Jerusalem is a blessing. Sulam Yaakov is a blessing. Land of Israel Network is a blessing. Being with Rabbi Mike is a blessing. And being in your ears is the greatest blessing of them all. Don't listen to my voice. Hear the voice of God. He is broadcasting from Israel 24/7. So stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected, and stay tuned because we have Malka Fleischer and myself talking about the Elor Azariah case coming up next and an appearance at the BBC. So stay tuned. Rabbi Mike, Shabbat Shalom, and thanks again.
Shabbat Shalom.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4 bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome back to the Yishai Fleischer Show. We're broadcasting right now from the Mount of Olives, overlooking the Temple Mount, looking out at the Golden Dome there. Placekeeper for the Third Temple, great job. Thank you. And also the flag of Israel flapping in the wind of a beautiful sunny winter's day here in Jerusalem, Israel, this incredible capital of the spiritual superpower, the land of Israel. It's awesome to be here, and I'm here with my beloved show hostess with the mostest, Malka Fleischer. Malka, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Yishai. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. And yesterday, you and I were, myself, and Elazar Menachem, our son, one of our sons, we're getting a haircut at my favorite haircut place, a place that I've been cutting my hair for 22 years. 22 years, Malka, I've been cutting my hair in the same place. I mean, with a break of 7 years while I was in America, but in any case, getting my haircut there for a very long time. And as we're getting a haircut...
You got a little bit of a new haircut this time.
A little bit of a new...
A tiny bit new. If you're on Facebook or on Instagram or on Periscope, they're on Twitter, keep your eyes out for the haircut.
Right. Yes. I'm not sure I'm comfortable talking about this publicly, but yes, the haircut's a tad different. And of course, that's because my mother has recently made Aliyah, and having my mom close to me means...
Opinions about haircuts.
Right. She can dictate things that were not dictatable, you know. And I'm a tough settler carrying a gun and stuff. But, you know, when your mama says you got to get a different haircut,
fold. I like it. I want everyone out there who, again, is on Facebook or on Twitter or on Periscope or on Instagram, find Yishai Fleischer. And you can feel free to comment whether you like the new haircut. You never know. You could have a powerful influence on Yishai's look in the future.
Speaking of haircuts, we were sitting at the haircut place. And there on the TV screen was the trial of the end of the trial.
The verdict.
The verdict of the trial of the Elora Azaria case. Elora Azaria is a soldier who shot a terrorist after the terrorist had already been downed and shot and seemingly was neutralized. He basically, for lack of a better word, executed him.
He finished it.
He finished the job. He took him out. He did what we call in Israel vidui hariga. He verified the kill. He finished him off. But this was a few minutes after this terrorist had tried to stab one of Elora Azaria's fellow soldiers. And also, there was some movement still from this terrorist. But the court found that the argument that Elora Azaria...
This was a military court.
The military court found that Elora Azaria acted improperly and was guilty of manslaughter for shooting at a downed terrorist.
We're awaiting sentencing.
Right, and now the next bit is sentencing. Of course, at the very moment of this trial was an incredible public, very, very public discussion here in Israel, including a public protest right outside of the courtroom, the military courtroom there, next to the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv. And a lot of people that were protesting were not protesting to see Elora Azaria punished more severely, rather asking Elora Azaria to be let go for the president of Israel to give him what's it called, pardoning, Chanina, and basically saying, get this off the TV screens. There's absolutely no reason to try one of our own people in such a public trial. And I think that's my opinion as well, and what I've been saying, which is, I'm not saying that Elora Azaria necessarily acted properly, okay? He shot somebody that was down, and he could have not necessarily shot him, and it would have been fine. Probably. I wasn't there in that scenario, but that's
from
the look
of it. Well, the argument was that because the terrorist was still moving, and you could see him moving in the video that was taken from a building across from the incident by B'Tselem, which is a radical leftist organization that fights... the Jewish presence pretty much anywhere, but especially in places in Judea and Samaria.
Starting with Judea and Samaria.
Right. And they took this video and then they brought Elora to trial, basically. But Elora's argument was that because this terrorist was still moving, he was still a threat. There have been instances in the past in which a terrorist was down and no one did anything with him, basically, and he either got back up and continued doing his work, or he pushed a button and exploded a suicide belt. And so his argument was always that he was just trying to ensure that this person was no longer a threat.
Right, and I'll never forget that in the day after this whole story broke, there was I forget the number, but there the name of, but there was a soldier. A former IDF soldier I think it was actually a former Magav border control soldier, like a half police officer, who had lost his legs from a terrorist who had exploded.
Right.
And he held up a sign saying, "You did the right thing. Don't let this happen to you. What happened to me?" Which is that I didn't shoot early enough. I didn't stop him
right,
early
enough. Right, that he hesitated. And this is what is the big, big argument right now.
Right.
Amongst the people, which is, as you probably know if you're listening to this show and you've been listening for a while, you know a little bit about Israel, and you know that IDF service is pretty much mandatory in this country, and that thousands and tens of thousands of Jewish youth are drafted every year to the pride of their parents, right? The parents support the IDF. A lot of those parents served in the IDF too. But still, you know, it's your kid and they're in the army and you're scared and you don't exactly want them to be there, right? You wish they were at home sitting next to you. And it's, you know, you're scared for your children no matter what kind of service that they do. It's dangerous service. So when these kids go into the field of duty, let's call it, certainly the field of battle, you want them to feel like if they have to defend themselves, if there is a threat, that they should act on that threat, because heaven forfend that they sacrifice themselves on the altar of being extremely cautious, right? So on the one hand, you want to watch out for the rights of even this disgusting, slimy villain who went out of his house that morning with a knife to plunge it into the back of Jews. You have to watch out for his rights because we are a quote-unquote democratic country and we're a country of rights, human rights. On the flip side, whose rights are more important? The rights of a disgusting scumbag or the rights of a person who's defending the Jewish country? So people are worried that soldiers, as a result of this case, will be hesitant to fire and that, God forbid, bad things will happen to them. This moment of hesitation will cause them to come to harm, and that it could be anyone's child. And nobody wants it to be their child.
Though I have to just tighten the point a little bit of the other side, which is nobody was saying this terrorist was shot. He was shot many times, and he was certainly going to die soon anyway.
No, certainly.
But there was a good likelihood he was down on the ground, and he really took a lot of bullets. And the question is, like, if you have a person who's down, do you shoot him at the end there? And they're saying nobody's stopping soldiers from shooting terrorists. Just like, you know, once a person's down, like, don't keep shooting. Now the problem is that it's very hard to call this manslaughter in my mind. It's very hard to call it manslaughter because the guy was a terrorist. He was already shot. He's on the ground. He may be dangerous. Doesn't even matter if he was or was not dangerous. He may be have been perceived to be dangerous. In any case, there's another set of thinking here which has to be a part of the story, which is this is the field of battle, the heat of battle. This is not some kind of police operation and dealing with some kind of cold, you know, criminal justice issue. This is the laws of armed conflict. This is the terrorists trying to kill Jews. And they're not trying to steal a car, right? They're really out to kill. That's what they came to do. They came to do mass murder. That's what they came to do.
By the way, with the intention, with the full knowledge that there's a great likelihood that they're going to die in the process.
Right. And imagine if Prime Minister Netanyahu would have just come out at a press conference after this video would have come out and would have said, look, we're going to investigate this. Just because there's this video that came out, we're going to investigate if everything was done properly according to our internal codes. But on top of that, every terrorist should know that when they come to kill Jews, they'll end up dead. That's all there is. They're not going to get the best medical treatment in the Middle East in Israel. They're going to end up dead. And that's the signal that we have to send the terrorists. Some of my friends, you know, that are more on the liberal side of the equation will say to me, but we have to be better and we have to show that we don't kill people at random and all kinds of, that we don't execute and all that. To me, it's like, to me, all that is a great confusion. We're at war. We need to send the enemy a signal that we will not be defeated.
It really depends on how seriously you take this terrorism.
Exactly.
If it's not that bad, and it's just kind of like a form of communication that we have with the other side.
Right.
They communicate by stabbing, and we communicate with words or whatever it is. Then maybe you shouldn't be shooting terrorists. But if this is an emergency.
Right.
And you must get rid of this notion of terrorism, or even just on the private level, this terrorist, then you're willing to take more extreme measures.
By the way, Malka, for many weeks after the Elora Azariah shooting, there was a drastic reduction in terrorism in Hebron.
Because everyone saw the video.
Right,
because
they could send
they're
the
like,
signal.
They're like, okay.
Yeah, that's what they're like, the Israelis. They take out bad guys. And I think that's a fine signal. I don't think there's anything, I don't think we need to be more moral than that. I think that's fantastically moral.
Right, so my take on the issue is that you're right. Meaning to say that you and I, we don't have an argument about this, that Elora Azariah may not have been right in his shooting. And my guess is that inside of his mind, on the, you know, at night when he's thinking about it, he wishes he had not pulled that trigger. He's not thinking to himself, I saved
well,
the whole.
He doesn't wish that because he's sad to see that terrorist go.
Oh, no.
He's
not
sad
because
our own
because
Israeli,
he got screwed over very badly.
Quote-unquote justice system, you know.
Because the justice system said, because the justice system punished him for
what they
perceived.
Forget even punished him. They tried him. They shouldn't have tried
him. Okay.
Publicly.
But they, I guess, that the idea was that he was doing justice rather than doing security. That's what I think that this thing hinges on. They thought that he was doing a revenge shooting. That his friend got stabbed in the back and that he took down the guy who did it and took justice into his own hands. And that is not what IDF soldiers, in theory, according to the law, are supposed, rather not in theory, but actually according to the law, that is not what they are there to do. They are there to do law, not justice. So that's what he's being punished for. Incidentally, he was not charged with or convicted of murder.
Right.
Right? He's not a murderer. He's convicted of manslaughter.
Right. My problem is that this shouldn't have been a trial at all. By the way, just think for yourself, even though it may should have been investigated maybe within the confines of the army, but not certainly not such a public trial. It was as though this...
Well, we're really going to see what happens. We'll really be able to tie this thing up when we see what sentencing
right.
looks like.
Right.
Because sentencing could be lenient. It could even be time served.
But why?
Or it could be something really, really long and horrible, in which case then this trial was really, really wrong. Meaning to say that the fact that the trial is public may end up being a good thing, Yishai, because
right.
it's part of the national dialogue about how we deal with terror and terrorism
right.
and what our personal relationship is to what's going on the ground. If I'm a soldier, how do I deal with a terrorist, not just on the legal sense, but what's going to happen to me vis-a-vis the state if I engage a terrorist all the way?
That's a very good point, Malka. And I think that at first, the trial was really about to appease the international community, which saw Israel doing in this video, saw Israel doing something seemingly immoral
right,
and all that.
It got out in the news and it was
got
ugly.
On the news. And the first answers of even the defense minister, who was at the time Bogi Yaalon, were negative. And they came out very publicly against Elora Azariah right at the onset.
Right. They made a judgment before he
right.
was even brought to trial.
And that's, by the way, one of the reasons why the defense is calling for a mistrial, saying it was prejudged, this whole thing, and it came out into the media and everybody was tinged by it. But very soon, it's exactly what you said happened, which is it became a Israeli trial. Not for the world to show trial, but for Israel. And it turned out that Israelis came out very strong on social media in defense of Elora Azariah.
On the street, you know, we
and
were in
street.
Your barbershop, Yishai, and
right.
there were other people in the barbershop.
Right.
And they were there was no question that everyone there was hoping that Elora Azariah would even be acquitted, but certainly would be judged leniently. I went out to get so Elazar got a haircut, right? He looks great. I went outside to get him an ice cream at a store next door, and there was a lady sitting there. And of course, on her news is also the whole, certainly Yerushalayim. I cannot speak for the rest of the country, but certainly here in Jerusalem, the atmosphere was that this guy is a decent person. He reacted in a way which a lot of people could see themselves reacting in if they were in that situation. A lot of people really relate to this, again, because so many people served in the army or their children are serving in the army, and they want their kids
right.
to be reacting in a way which is not weak at the knees, in a way which is going to assure 100% their personal and security and the security of the people around them. And everyone I'm encountering, you are encountering people who think that it's great that Alora Zarya is convicted, possibly. I'm not encountering
no,
these
no,
people.
No, 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 no.
The people I'm encountering in my circles are all wanting Alora Zarya to go home to his family.
Right. And I think you made another good point, which is that this is not detached for Israelis. This isn't detached some kind of trial that they can have a moral opinion on or not. This is about their kids. It's not about Alora Zarya and that terrorist and what he did. It's about, like, are our kids going to be empowered to shoot back fast and aggressively?
Right.
And as they say in Apocalypse Now, with extreme prejudice.
Right.
With extreme
and this
prejudice.
This is, by the way, not a these are not professional soldiers that we're talking
right.
about.
We're talking about
these
18, 19, 20-year-olds.
Kids, and
right.
everyone can remember. All those people, I'm sure you, Ishai, and I'm sure other people out there who served in the Army, they can flash back to moments where they were in danger and remember the feelings and at very least feel a lot of empathy for Alor and his situation. It's not like ludicrous to anyone that he shot. The question is sort of whether it was right or wrong, whether it's right that he goes to trial, whether it's right the conviction, all these things. But I can't think of a single person that I've met who's like, I cannot believe he shot that guy.
Right.
That's crazy.
Right.
Everyone thinks to themselves, you know, okay, like I could see that.
Monica, I want to tie this into one last point here, and that's also the United Nations Security Council vote. And the way I want to tie it in is to say, look, you're looking at the TV, and you know what's under attack? Israel's under attack. The Jewish right to live in ancient Jewish places, because at the end of the day, this attack did happen in Hebron, the one that Alora Zarya reacted to. It was a terrorist act in Hebron. And the thing that's really under attack is courage. It's like the courage to live out in the settlements, in Judea and Samaria, in the Jewish communities, the new Jewish communities that are being born in this ancient land. And the people that move out there are courageous, mostly. And Alora Zarya acted maybe not super rationally, but certainly courageously, and acted with Jewish strength. That's really the point there. He acted by a Jew using an M16 to shoot down jihadists. That's a great innovation of Zionism and of the modern era. And all that is being under attack. And to watch the TV and to see how many countries was it, 14, 15 countries, vote against Jewish rights in their ancestral homeland. And then to see our own courts, Israeli military courts, judging a young soldier so publicly for shooting down somebody who came to kill Jews, you know, one could get a little bit, you know, like, wow, like this is a bit, this is not going the right direction. The world is against us. Our own courts are against us. And yet what I feel is actually the opposite. I felt that the minute that the world decided on Hanukkah that we had no rights to live in Judea and Samaria, there was even across the spectrum, even in the Israeli left, many people were like, hey, this is wrong. The world, this is anti-Semitic.
This
people
is
are against
so,
us.
I have to comment about this, Isha. I'm sorry if I'm interrupting you.
No, that's why you're
on
the show.
I have a lot of feelings about this one.
That's why you're on the show, babe.
Okay? When I found out that the UN Security Council had voted unanimously, almost, I'm counting America, okay, America? I'm counting you, because an abstention is a vote. We all know this, okay?
And there's a lot of evidence mounting now that the United States, the Obama administration, more correctly, was behind the initiation of
this
vote.
America did this. We all know it.
Right, we all know it, right?
Okay?
It's fingerprints are all over it.
We need you to know that, Americans who are listening, we all know. I'm not blaming you, you nice, sweet people who are listening on the radio, okay? But we know that your country, America, did this.
Let's keep it to the administration. I think that's the
American administration. And it could be, by the way, that their representatives in Congress who reacted very, very negatively to this. And I know that there's going to be a push inside of the United States to repeal this or whatever that means. Okay. But when I found out that this vote happened and the world essentially unanimously came out against Israel, I was overjoyed. I love it. It's perfect. Couldn't have happened better. I believe a couple of things. One, Hanukkah. You couldn't have chosen a better holiday to do this to us when the Hellenists come against us, when the entire empire comes down on tiny little Judea to crush it. And then the tiny little people burst out and annihilate and push out and terrify and overwork the empire. And push it back and rededicate our temple. thank you very much. I couldn't hope for better. A better metaphor.
It fits the script.
It's perfect. It's perfect. Right. It's like the energy of Hanukkah came right back.
Right.
Secondly, I'm not sure if I want to reveal this secret now to non-Jews who are listening out.
Yeah, but you already told them about my haircut.
I told them about your haircut, but they're going to notice it in your pictures each time on social media.
Okay. So what's your secret?
Here's my secret, and I hope you will not use it against us non-Jews, but I'm going to let the secret out. And Yisha, you've told the secret before, I think, in previous shows. There is nothing better for Jewish unity than when someone comes, an enemy comes against us. You know, we had just dealt with Amona. It was not pretty. The question of Judea and Samaria isn't exactly back on the table, but it's sort of there in the atmosphere again. Should you, you know, how much rights should we be giving to Arabs in Judea and Samaria and Jews in Judea and Samaria, and how much power should we be giving to Jordanian law in Judea and Samaria, which is the precedent in the area? How much should we be settling in Judea and Samaria? And now to have the entire world come out and say, Jews should not be in Judea and Samaria. Just like you said, Yisha, even the left is like, who the heck are you? Why should we be listening to you? You know what? Yesterday, I didn't think Jews should live in Judea and Samaria. Today, screw you guys. We're going to all move to Judea and Samaria. So the thought process here in Israel about Judea and Samaria suddenly perked up tremendously. The notion that Jews should live in Judea and Samaria has suddenly become positive to people who before it was negative. Because when the whole world comes out against the Jewish people, that's when they unite. It's a little bit of a sick psychology. I'm not going to say it's the perfect way, but it's true. It is unquestionably true that when the Jewish people are pushed against by a threatening enemy, we come together and you just cannot break us. It's not possible to do. So thank you, United States of America. You know, the Obama administration is going to go down looking like jerks. And it leaves us with a wonderful lesson and a great feeling as the Trump era comes in. I hope it will be good. The Trump era will really be determined by how strong Bibi will be and not how strong Donald will be. But that all remains to be seen.
Right. And even Strategic Affairs Minister Yuval Steinitz was just so disappointed in the Obama administration, how it all ended. But I think that's good because there was a lot of people who doubted and thought the Obama administration was maybe a nice guy administration that we misunderstood and they just wanted to see Iran flourish.
Maybe it's like a mean righty who doesn't know how to deal with Obama. Right. But it turns out that's not the case.
Anyway, Malka Fleischer, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It was also an awesome Hanukkah. We had a great time. We went down to a place where Simon the Maccabee made a fort and an installation there, fought Tryphon, the Syrian general, defeated him. And in the distance from this fort where Simon was 2,000 years ago, we saw Tel Aviv flourishing in the distance. And just this feeling that, you know, I literally cried because I just felt that the Maccabean Revolution, the return, the rededication, the warding off of foreign control and foreign influence, I think it was an amazing Hanukkah, and I think all those emotions came together. And I just want to say that Alor Azariah is going to work out for him. He's going to work out what he did may have not been, by the way, the most perfect thing, but it set off a chain reaction of people to awaken to the idea of Jewish strength. Don't worry about what the courts say; it's what the people say which really matters. And there's a revolution afoot, an evolution, I think, afoot here. A return to classical Zionist value, a return to Jewish strength, Jewish courage, and I think there's more awareness of God in Israel more than ever before in the modern state of Israel. And I think that there's a little rededication that's happening in our hearts. Malka Fleischer, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you, Ishai. We should have good news.
Amen. Amen. Now, stay tuned right now, just for another second, to hear my interview on the BBC World Service with Owen Bennett-Jones. That's the name, Owen Bennett-Jones. He's a famous broadcaster on the BBC. And we talked a little bit about the things of the issues of the State of Israel. So here's my interview on the BBC.
Well, Yishai Fleischer is a spokesman for the Jewish settler community in Hebron. What does he think?
The problem really is not the decision of the court, but it's the fact that this went to a public trial. I think most people in Israel agree that the action itself of shooting a downed terrorist was maybe not the best or the smartest decision to make, not the best act. But to try a soldier publicly, to hang him kind of in a public hanging, was a big mistake, because at the end of the day, we're at war with terror here in Israel. And this soldier, what he did, even if he may have shot a little after the fact that the terrorist had already been shot, at the end of the day, he's protecting the homeland. He's protecting it from a gigantic jihad that encircles us. And so therefore, we're sending the wrong signal to our young soldiers to think too many times before shooting somebody who came to kill Israelis and Jews and is really a jihadist terrorist.
Against that, Israel portrays itself as a democracy, so the rule of law should be seen to be done, shouldn't it?
That's a very good question. I think the question is, which rule of law? There is two kinds of law when you deal with these kind of situations. One, you have criminal justice law, and one is the laws of armed conflict. In terms of a war, if this enemy combatant came into the camp and started knifing soldiers and was shot, and then again he may have moved and may have been a little bit suspicious and a soldier shot him under the rules of armed conflict, that's not something to go to trial with. At the end of the day, the soldier shot a terrorist who came to kill and was a dangerous enemy combatant. If we're talking about a normal situation of criminal justice and this young Elor Azaria, the soldier, was a police officer in a regular criminal setting, well, that would have been something very different. Here, we're talking about armed conflict. We're talking about a war zone. We're talking about people who are sworn to, not criminals trying to steal a car, but people sworn to destroy the Jewish community in Hebron and in Israel, and the soldier reacted. Again, let me make it clear, I'm not saying that he necessarily acted in the best way possible. I'm just asking whether it was a good idea to put a public trial, a show trial, and to come out with a verdict that in the end weakens the IDF and strengthens the jihad.
And when talking about the rule of law, it's only right to say, isn't it, that the settlements have been declared illegal by the international community now.
That is certainly the case, that the United Nations Security Council has deemed our presence in our historic homeland to be illegal. We're going to fight tooth and nail to change that decision. I think the incoming president of the United States and other parties around the world see this as a great injustice to tell the Jewish people that after all that we've been through, that we can't live in our ancestral homeland and the places that our forefathers and mothers are buried.
Doesn't that bother you, though, that if you give up on international law as a yardstick, you know, the very creation of Israel depended on a UN vote, and if you're really just dismissing that as irrelevant, if you happen to disagree with it, doesn't that undermine your case in the long term?
The truth is that the United Nations accepted the decisions of the League of Nations in 1920 and 1923 under Article 90. The United Nations accepted the premises that 53 countries got together at San Remo and at the League of Nations and decided that all of the land of Israel, certainly west of the Jordan River, belongs to the Jewish people as our national home. And I think the world has actually forgotten their own international legal decisions that are much more binding than the latest batch.
Just on the case of the soldier who's been convicted of manslaughter, almost certainly the case, isn't it, that if it hadn't been filmed, this would never have happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. At the end of the day, I think there are some people in the Israeli establishment that react kind of cowardly to these kind of things. I think that the Prime Minister of Israel should have come out and said, listen, something happened. We're going to investigate it within the privacy of the organization of the Israeli Defense Force, of the army. But at the end of the day, every jihadist, every terrorist has to know that when they come to face Israel, when they come to kill Jewish civilians, they will lose their life. They will find themselves dead. And that's the message that should have been sent. And also at the same time, let me stress again, I'm not saying that necessarily the soldier who shot after the terrorist has fallen was a good or right thing.
Well, you're getting very close to it. I mean.
No. I'm making a very fine distinction. I wish he hadn't. I think it would have been just absolutely fine if he hadn't, and that terrorist would have either been arrested or would have died because of, don't forget that the terrorist had already been shot many times. I'm not saying that the terrorist should be shot while downed. However, at the same time, when such things happen in the heat of action, don't forget we're talking about not a sterile laboratory. We're talking about, you know, in the heat of battle, a soldier shoots a downed terrorist. Again, not maybe the greatest act, but should be seen as something in within the acts of war.
And that was Yishai Fleischer there, a spokesman for the Jewish settler community in Hebron.
All right, folks, great being with you here on the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world on the Land of Israel Network. Check out all our other great shows at thelandofisrael.com. Great stuff. Thank you very much, Ari and Jeremy, and the rest of the good folks that make it happen. Thank you to my friends who sponsor the show. All of you out there really make a tremendous difference. Without you, I couldn't do it. Thank you to Moshe Herman who helps produce the show, Ben Bresky and Tabitha, the good folks at the Land of Israel Network. Thank you to Malka Fleischer for joining me today. Thank you to Rabbi Mike Foyer. Thank you to God Almighty, who has given us the strength to broadcast to the world. And that's what I want to wish you, lots of strength. Don't let the Elora Azariah case, don't let the United Nations Security Council get you down. Give that Hanukkah spirit a chance to grow inside of you all year. We are being reborn in this land. It is an incredible time, and the light of the menorah is lit right now. It is lit. We're lighting it. The first candle's been lit. The second candle's been lit. All the way to the seventh candle. That's the time that we're living in. We're living in the era of the third temple. Don't let anybody douse your fire. Keep that light burning. Keep that energy high. That's all we need right now is high energy, high excitement. Don't let anybody get you down. We're going to get through it, and we're going to enter an incredible, incredible time that has been awaiting for us for many, many years. It is our destiny. It is the world's destiny, and great times are ahead. Stay tuned. Stay strong. Stay connected, and don't forget to write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. God bless you, and shalom.
Hey folks, this is Jeremy Gimpel. I want you to know, if you're a non-Jew from a Christian background or just a full-fledged Christian and you want to come to Israel, the best program, tour, experience that you could possibly have is to go with Hayovel. Now it's weird, I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi and I'm telling Christians to go to this Christian ministry in the middle of Samaria. Let me tell you, there is no better experience for someone outside of the land, outside of the Jewish fold, to come into the land and work alongside the Jewish farmers of Samaria, to learn about the culture, to meet the people. It's an experience like no other, and I think it's also probably the cheapest way to travel to Israel. So go to hayovel.com.